Our first presenter is Ms. Fazila Rotz, Director of the Cambridge Prevention Coalition. And as I said earlier, that's a community-based organization working towards reducing drug and alcohol use among young people in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The CPC's Responsible Beverage Service Training Program, called 21 Proof, won the NASIDAD Exemplary Award for Innovative Substance Abuse Prevention Programs in 2007. Ms. Rotz has worked with numerous other communities seeking to implement 21 Proof and is currently working with the prevention coalitions in Rhode Island to launch 21 Proof in that state. She also directs the CPC's other work, including a peer leadership program, a social marketing campaign, and incorporating new electronic media into the coalition's prevention efforts. Ms. Rotz holds a master's in gender and social policy from the London School of Economics and has previously worked as a program manager, research assistant, and departmental director in substance abuse prevention, research, and community action. Welcome, Fazila, and thank you for joining us on our call today.
Thank you so much, Aiden. So as Aiden mentioned, we are in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I'm just going to talk a little bit about how we've worked to reduce underage drinking through reducing commercial access to alcohol in our community. And to start off, on my next slide, I kind of talk a little bit about what RBS, or Responsible Beverage Service Training, is. It is a training program, for those of you who don't know, for both pouring or serving establishments, such as bars and restaurants, and non-pouring or cellar establishments, such as package stores and liquor stores. The goal of an RBS is really to reduce sales to minors and to also reduce high-level and high-risk intoxication of other patrons. And just as a side note, throughout my presentation, I'll often be referring to the pouring and non-pouring establishments as just generically as licensees. On the next slide, I just want to say a few words about the alcohol licensing process in Massachusetts, because it's a little bit complicated, and just so you kind of know how this works. In Massachusetts, the licensing process begins with a city or town. The local licensing authority, usually a commission or a board, here in Cambridge, it's a commission actually approves the license. The local licensing authority then sends the application to the ABCC for approval. And the ABCC is the Alcohol Beverage Control Commission, and it's a statewide regulatory commission. Only after the approval from the ABCC is the license issued by the local licensing authority. The license fee is determined by and paid to the local license authority at the time of the licensee that the licensee receives the license. So like I said, the ABCC is really the state regulatory board that has oversight over the local license commissions, and they also conduct many of the statewide compliance checks and that sort of thing. On the next slide, I start talking a little bit more about the making of 21 Proof. 21 Proof, are the Cambridge Prevention Coalition's RBS program, kind of grew out of a number of issues. First, there was an increase in community's concern around underage commercial access to alcohol. And there were a variety of incidents that within the city that kind of led to this, including some college-age deaths, and a lot of failed compliance checks and things like that. And so in the late 1990s, that really kind of increased the community's desire to address this. This was really followed by a needs assessment process, which included looking at student survey data, existing environmental approaches to reducing commercial access, as well as outlet density and other compliance check data. A lit review was then conducted on RBS and other environmental approaches, although we decided to stick with RBS. And we then went on to kind of try to figure out what some of the best practices within RBS are. We then conducted some focus groups with the local licensees, of which Paul is one, to really kind of get their input on what they see as necessary, as useful, and all of that. the 21 proof training was then created and based on licensee needs and the best practices from the literature, namely from Toomey's article in 1998, which I'll go over a little bit more in just a moment. And we also had a very strong emphasis on evaluation. We really wanted to make sure that we could show our funders, because we are grant funded, that whatever it was we were creating was going to be able to have some measurable success. So in the next slide, I go more in depth into what Toomey found as being four vital components to successful RBS training. The Toomey paper actually evaluated 22 server programs and found that no existing RBS programs covered all of the four essential content areas that Toomey and the other researchers found to really reduce commercial access. The first of these four is training of managers as well as servers and sellers, so having a separate training program for managers or owners. The second is providing information about why changing a given behavior is important. The third being addressing the policies and practices of the establishment, so knowing, you know, what establishment's rules are around checking IDs and the like. And then the fourth is using behavioral change techniques that incorporate communication methods. So a lot of kind of role playing and that sort of thing. These findings led the Cambridge work group to propose the development of a local RBS program utilizing both, like I said, the local data and lessons from the literature on what would constitute best practices in program design. On the next slide, I talk a little bit more about our partners. This is really a community effort. As I said, it really started because of community concern. And out of all of this, 21 Proof was born. So there's the Cambridge Prevention Coalition, who I direct, and we provide the training, the day-to-day management, and keeping an eye on the theory and the practice, and we tweak the trainings when needed. We do a lot of the coordination and that sort of thing with the local licensees. The Cambridge License Commission, who has been very involved in this process from the very beginning, refers a lot of the licensees for 21 Proof training, including new managers, owners, and other new licensees, as well as people who fail compliance or may come up before the License Commission for any one of a number of other reasons. And there's also the Cambridge Licensee Advisory Board, whom Paul represents, and he'll be speaking in just a few moments, who really help meet and assist and promote 21 Proof. They kind of really give us a lot of relevant feedback and keep the training relevant for us. And finally, our evaluator, SSRE, Social Science Research and Evaluation, based in Burlington, Massachusetts, they assist with all the evaluation, which includes ensuring that the pre and the post tests show that the training is still being effective, making sure that we're making a measurable difference. And just as a side note, Scott Formica of SSRE is also on the call and will be available later to answer any other questions that may come up. So in the next slide, I talk about the objectives of 21 Proof. We really sat down and made sure that the RBS was going to meet certain objectives and then kind of designed it around that. The first being to increase knowledge of RBS practices among vendors and servers of alcohol. The second, to improve skills related to RBS practices among vendors and servers of alcohol. The third, to decrease the proportion of underage youth obtaining alcohol from commercial sources. And the fourth, to increase compliance with underage drinking laws among vendors and servers of alcohol. So how do we do this? On the next slide, I talk about the different sections that 21 Proof entails. And I should note here that it's the top four that really kind of constitute the server and seller components. So the first section is setting the stage, which includes data on underage drinking in Cambridge, as well as some state data so that we kind of make this very relevant for the people taking the training. The second part talks a lot about drinking versus intoxication, identifies and defines these issues, talks about, you know, different serving sizes of alcohol, like the beer versus wine versus hard liquor, and talks about addiction and what addiction means and what that looks like. The third section is knowing the laws, which covers the Massachusetts general laws as well as regulations for serving and selling alcohol in the city of Cambridge, because we do have specific rules here in Cambridge that are a little bit different or that are maybe a little more stringent than some of the Massachusetts general laws. we don't have any laws that are more lax, I'll say. The fourth section is making a difference, which really offers participants the opportunity to do some skill development, and includes a lot of role plays to really kind of help support making the behavior changes. And then the best practices module is what we use with managers and owners, and it really focuses on the development of establishment-level RBS policies and procedures. So looking at a licensee's policies, how they kind of log incidents, making sure they have the supplies they need to make sure they, you know, they're not, they know how to check for fake IDs and the like, and really to help managers and owners make sure that their servers and sellers are able to enforce the law. And we do have, so we have really a total of four trainers, one for servers, one for sellers, and then one for managers and owners of pouring establishments, and one for seller, managers and owners of selling establishments. On the next slide, I go into the evaluation, which I think is really important. We have a very strong emphasis on evaluation for this program. We have matched pretests and post-tests of all training participants. We have community-level indicator data for the pouring component. And a lot of the indicator data, you know, it's outlet density, it's how many licensees we have, what kind of licensees we have, but we also have student survey data and things like that. And we also did a pseudo-buyer pilot study of non-pouring best practices component. And the pseudo-buyer pilot study was really, is kind of like a compliance check, but we kind of devised our own set of rules around that. They're not, you know, anything different than most people, but it was kind of to make sure that we had data which would stand up to any rigorous evaluation. So in the next slide, I talk a little bit about what we have found our trainings to do. We have the pretest and post-test, like I said, and the results, we have results from over 1,200 servers and sellers who were trained across 104 trainings between August 2000 and May 2008. So we have a vast amount of information. Of those, 27% showed a significant increase in RBS knowledge from pretest to post-test. So looking at the tests and the surveys and looking at exactly, you know, the five items, I believe, that score different levels of knowledge. And then an 11% significant improvement in RBS-related skills from pretest to post-test. And that was based on two Likert scales questions. And then the next slide shows a little bit more about the commercial access regards to underage drinkers or underage youth, specifically for 11th and 12th graders in our community. As you can see from this slide, at baseline, about 16.5% of students who reported drinking in the last 30 days were getting their alcohol from commercial sources. Over the course of the intervention, that went down to just under 9%, which is a very nice decrease. Post-intervention, it went back up to about 15.5%. So we were able to show that during the intervention, we really were making a difference. And finally, on the last slide, I talk a little bit about compliance checks. And what you can see here is this was for the pseudo-buyer compliance check that we conducted right before or while we were starting our best practices for managers of non-pouring establishments. And while the percentage of stores who failed compliance among non-trained establishments stayed the same, we were able to show a 12% decrease in failure rates among those stores who did participate in the training, which is that's a 30% reduction in the odds of a trained establishment failing a compliance check. So that's all I have. The last slide just lists some of my contact information. And I also provided Aiden with some handouts, a little bit more, a research brief shortly on some of our other evaluation information. We are currently working with other communities to put 21 Proof into their, into their communities, working with their licensees and all of that. And as I mentioned, if anyone has any other specific evaluation-based questions during the question and answer, Scott Promita will be on the call as well. So that's all I've got. Thank you so much, Aiden.
Thank you, Gazila. And excuse me, for those of you who are following along with today's presentation online, on your screen now you can see the addresses where the presenters' materials are available to you for downloading. If you copy that and paste it right into your browser, you'll be able to access some of the things that Gazila was speaking about, including the documents that are discussing Proof 21 and the success that it's enjoyed. So thank you for starting us off with some great information. And for those of you who have joined us on our audio call late, our topic today is on-premise enforcement and retailer training opportunities. You may access the simultaneous web presentation at www.ilinc.com/on-demand. The conference ID number for the web presentation is 108-5272. Our second speaker this afternoon is a businessman and a licensee in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. That is Mr. Paul Lee, and he's the owner of the Hong Kong restaurant in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He's been in the restaurant industry for over 30 years, working in his family's restaurant, and has worked full-time there for the past 22 years. He's a member of the Cambridge Licensee Advisory Board, whose goal it is to prevent underage drinking and promote responsible service since 2002. And he was the president of that organization from 2005 to 2007. In 2006, Mr. Lee received the Responsible Retailer of the Year Award from the Cambridge Prevention Coalition for his work around the issue of underage alcohol and responsible serving practices. He is the current co-chair of the Harvard Square Business Association Restaurant Committee and a former board member of the Harvard Square Business Association from 2005 to 2007. He is currently a board member of the Cambridge Office of Tourism. Welcome, Paul, and thank you for spending some time with us today.
Thank you, Aiden. I'd like to say hello to everybody. As Aiden mentioned, my name is Paul Lee, and I have a family-owned business here. We've been in Cambridge since 1954, and we're also Cambridge residents, so we certainly have a vested interest in the well-being of our community. My mother and father started the business in 1954, and just a little brief history, we got a liquor license in about 1970, and today we have three floors, and the first floor is a dining room, the second floor is a bar, and the third floor we have a dance floor two nights a week, and we have comedy six nights a week. I'd like to start by highlighting a couple of facts that, from a retailer point of view, that makes Massachusetts and Cambridge a little different from other parts of the country. Massachusetts, in here, we only accept, or Massachusetts only recognizes four types of IDs, of driver's license, a Massachusetts liquor ID, driver's license, a Massachusetts liquor ID, a military ID, or a passport. So with three universities here in Cambridge, as well as many, many more in the surrounding areas, we knew that we would see people from around the country as well as around the globe. So therefore, we knew that in order to stay in business, we should probably take out-of-state IDs, which are not recognized by the state of Massachusetts. We realized that it's at our own risk, but we knew that that was probably key to staying in business. What I mean by recognized IDs is that we would have a defense if we were caught serving an underage. We would have a defense in front of the License Commission if we accepted one of the Massachusetts recognized IDs. And we could potentially, if everything was perfect in terms of the picture and the information and the height and eye color, that we may not get a penalty. But if we were to take something that wasn't on this list, then, for example, if we took an out-of-state ID from, say, New Hampshire, which is very close, then we would have no defense at all. So we would be penalized accordingly. Also here in Massachusetts, as Gazela mentioned, we have two license commissions, one local and one state. And what this means for a retailer is that you have two agencies doing unannounced compliance checks. So we certainly understand the risk of underage drinking with the two agencies watching. Some of the other things, we can hire police officers, Cambridge police officers, as paid details. This certainly helps with the prevention of underage drinking because we can prevent people from getting in at the door, and also we can prevent people who are intoxicated from getting in by refusing them right at the door. We're also certainly fortunate to have organizations such as the Cambridge Prevention Coalition here in Cambridge that offer such wonderful programs, again, such as the 21 Proof program that Gazela was mentioning. We are also lucky to have a very forward-thinking local license commission that realized back in the 90s that the standard form of punishment for violating liquor laws, they had to think beyond that. So what they did was they started an organization called CLAB, which was the Cambridge Licensee Advisory Board. In the very beginning, it was a punishment for licensees that served alcohol to minors. It later became a proactive group comprised of non-offenders committed to the prevention of underage drinking. Again, also what we try to do is we promote programs designed to educate and support license holders in their efforts to prohibit sales to minors and to undertake any activities which promote respect for the Massachusetts liquor license laws. As the former president of the CLAB, I got to see firsthand the ability of a group to impact the community to prevent underage drinking and to promote responsible service. Our group includes the chair of the license commission and the executive director, as well as a representative from the Prevention Coalition to keep us apprised of the programs and trainings they have going on. We also have representatives from the local universities that keep us up to date on what their programs are with respect to the prevention of underage drinking. I believe it's this type of group collaboration with the blessing of the License Commission and the Prevention Coalition that makes it possible for us to make a priority of the prevention of underage drinking in the community through these trainings and programs. Some of these programs that we have, obviously we talked about the 21 Proof that we all have access to as licensees. We also have another program in Cambridge called the Cambridge Safe Ride, where we have subsidized cab rides for customers on certain high-risk nights. And what I mean by that are nights such as New Year's Eve or St. Patrick's Day. We try to highlight the fact that you don't need to drink and drive. You can take public transportation to an establishment, and you're able to get a free cab ride home up to a $35 value. Now, of course, all these programs aren't free. It costs a lot of money. So we also put on another event, which we call the Taste of Cambridge. This event is run by the Cambridge Licensee Advisory Board. And what we do is we highlight Cambridge restaurants while raising funds for these programs as well as other local charities. So you may be thinking, well, how do I do this in my community? I really believe it's important to organize a group of licensees through either a business association or a local chamber of commerce. And in fact, one of our members started a brand new group in an area where she was. She had a separate location, and they didn't have any kind of local group there. So she went around talking to everybody, talking to all the licensees, and getting them to try to meet to form a local group. So one of the other ways, I would talk to your local license commission, or if you don't have a local license commission, a state license commission, to see if they could help you organize a group. They are certainly more receptive to you if you are being proactive rather than reactive to problems. And finally, I'd say talk to your local police department. We're very lucky here in Cambridge to have a police commissioner who understands the value of having an open dialogue with proactive licensees. Some of the things I'd like to see, the trends, but I'd like to see change . For us on a local level. Obviously, I mentioned that Massachusetts only recognizes 4 IDs. So hopefully with some help from the legislature, we'd be able to have the state licenses added. On a national level, I'd certainly love to see some license standardization, if not some sort of national ID. And I know that's a hot topic. Some of the things I'd like to see as well is less reliance on technology. I know that some of the people now use scanners to scan IDs to see whether they're old enough. But what I feel with that is that it takes away from the people actually looking at the ID and looking at the person who's presenting the ID. I'd like to see more reliance on the actual ID books and also things like UV lights where you can see the holograms or watermarks and also magnifiers, because there are some microprinting on some licenses. Some of the other things I'd like to see is a cots and shops program for on-premise pouring establishments, I'll call them, bars and restaurants. Currently, if you don't know what a cots and shops program is, basically there is a police officer who is stationed inside a cellar, someone who sells at a takeaway or we call them package stores here, but they pose as employees and they're looking to apprehend underage persons who are attempting to buy alcohol or to purchase, or adults who are trying to purchase alcohol for minors. I'd certainly love to see an on-premise version of this program where people are stationed at a door to an establishment, and it basically would take the onus off of the premise where we're taking all the risk. I believe, it's at least my opinion, that we take all the risk in serving, and there are fewer consequences for the person who's presenting a fake ID. And finally, I'd like to say that I believe that retailers assume a responsibility to be a positive impact on the community. And what I mean by this is that we follow the liquor laws. However, I believe that retailers are only one piece of the puzzle to the prevention of underage drinking. One part is a strong bond with the law enforcement, and not in a reactive way again, but in a proactive way, in a partner with the police. Another would be a strong bond with the license commission. Another component is parent responsibility, and the most important piece, I believe, is education of the effects of alcohol and abuse of alcohol, especially at a young age. I hope you found my presentation helpful. I hope you'll be able to take some of these ideas and implement them in your community. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul, for sharing your information and perspective on the role of the licensee in the community on the topic of underage alcohol access, and I'm sure we'll have some questions for you as we line up those questions later on in our presentation. I'd like to introduce our third speaker this afternoon, who is Sergeant Scott Friedline from the Champaign, Illinois Police Department. Sergeant Friedline began his law enforcement career in 1985 and has held a variety of specialized positions during his career. Since 1995, he has been in charge of the department's alcohol enforcement unit. In this position, he has developed comprehensive alcohol enforcement programs that include enforcement strategies, educational programs, and policy development for the 168 licensed premises within that community. He is a consultant with the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation, the Underage Drinking Enforcement Training Center, and is on the advisory board of the National Liquor Law Enforcement Association. He is a certified TIPS trainer and has provided responsible beverage service training for nearly 2,000 bar employees. He has developed an 8-hour training program specifically for bar security personnel and a variety of enforcement trainings, including a 40-hour alcohol enforcement officer school, which is certified for Illinois law enforcement officers. He is an expert consultant for the Illinois Prevention First and has helped to develop a policy development for alcohol policy. He has provided instruction and technical assistance in Illinois and across the United States on alcohol policy and enforcement programs. And he specializes in enforcement strategies for college communities, bar security trainings, and illegal identification trainings. So, welcome, Scott, and thank you for taking time from your day to participate in our call today.
Thank you, Aiden, and welcome to everybody. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'd like to start basically by saying, in hearing Mr. Lee's comments, it's very refreshing to find owners who embrace the concept of public safety in the way you do, in particular with the ideas of training and making sure that you are a viable part of the community and a good neighbor. And I think that's key to what we're really talking about today, both from an enforcement standpoint and a retailer training standpoint. To give you an idea, if we can go to the next slide, I'm going to talk a little bit about the success of Champaign. And to give you an idea of what Champaign, Illinois is like, we're the home of the University of Illinois, the flagship institution for the state of Illinois. Within that community, we have some 40,000 students. We also have a junior college, Parkland College, which is 12,000 additional students. We are a Twin City community. Our neighbor to the east is Urbana, Illinois, and oftentimes referred to as the home of the University of Illinois. In addition to that, Champaign itself has over 168 licensed premises, over 50 of which are in our campus area. And recognizing that we are trying to address underage drinking issues, you can imagine that with that number of licensees, especially in a campus environment, we have many, many challenges in front of us. 11 bars and taverns are located within that area, and they have an occupancy of approximately 6,000 people. In terms of where we're at in the scope of the state of Illinois, we're about 2 hours due south of Chicago and about an hour and a half due west of Indianapolis. Next slide, please. Over the years, we've had a number of opportunities to really work with our retailers and to work on enforcement issues, and that success has been shown. In particular, over the last 4 years, we've maintained an average of 92% compliance throughout the community, and in actuality, in our campus area, it's even higher. The majority of our licensed premises in the campus area and in more of our entertainment districts do participate voluntarily in server training, which is provided by the police department as a key element of one of the things that we do. In addition to that, we've seen very great success with the decreases in violent crimes and decreases in calls for service as reported by licensees and by community members in those areas, with a certain amount of significance in terms of officers having more free time than to deal with other types of issues that communities do encounter. Next slide, please. How do we get here? The bottom line is, especially when I go back and look at the history of my involvement, being the first person to be in charge of alcohol enforcement in the city of Champaign, and looking at how we could take some of the concerns we had and try to mold those and fix those, the first thing I discovered was that there was a need for relationship building. I don't think there's many communities that aren't experiencing certain types of attitudes related to that relationship. Historically, obviously, a lack of trust between law enforcement and the industry, bars and licensees, attitudes related to, from a law enforcement perspective, you're creating the problems, you need to fix it, attitudes by licensees indicating that we in law enforcement are out to get them. And so those types of issues really kind of surfaced as we looked at how to fix some of the issues and really make our communities as safe as possible. One of the things that we realized we also needed to do is we wanted to work together to define what success is in measuring success. And as I look at success, especially in the bar and alcohol environment, we want our licensees to be good neighbors. We want them to be responsible offenders, and we want them to be good community partners. And so in doing that, we looked at those measures of success of good compliance rates, reduction in youth access, reduction in calls for service, safe environments, etc. And so those became measures of success. Within the licensee, we recognized the need for the licensee to be able to make a profit and be successful and do the things and provide the social environment that is critical to the wealth and health, I guess, of the community. We also looked at comparison of those goals to what the other stakeholders were concerned about? Did the stakeholders in the community feel that these were goals that were applicable to everybody? Especially when you take a campus environment and put bars right next to it, you do have a variety of mixed opinions about how to address some of those issues and again, what that measure of success is. Another aspect of this is, if they call the police, will the problem be used against them? In a lot of communities, the simple phone call to the police department saying, hey, we've got a problem here, can result in some kind of action against the licensee. And that creates concerns for licensees in the fact that they don't want to call because they're fearful that it may come back to bite them. That they may be fined, they may be closed down, those types of issues. So a real definition of what constitutes proactive enforcement activities by the licensee on their premises versus a reactive type of problem from law enforcement going to a problem that was potentially preventable by staff on the licensee. Next slide, please. Another aspect of this is an open book. Oftentimes, law enforcement, I think, goes into things and people are a little suspect because of the nature of the hidden environment that we work. We can't tell you things, guarded information, those types of issues that come up. And I'm a firm believer and have had a great deal of success in looking at that open book aspect. You want to know how we do something, I'm not afraid to tell you about that. If we are conducting compliance checks, I'll tell you how we set up our compliance check program. I'll tell you everything as far as the licensee goes. I'll tell that licensee everything up to but short of the day and time I'm coming to pay them a visit. And I think that is important for them to recognize that we don't have secrets. The more they understand about how we operate helps them in dealing with the issues occurring on their premises, dealing with their employees, encouraging compliant behavior on the part of their employees, and that if they do have a failure, that they understand that we followed certain rules to make sure that we were doing things correctly, and in that process, then the recognition that there may have been a problem that needed to be addressed internally. We want them to be compliant with the laws. We want them to understand what those laws are, and we want to be consistent in our message to them. The issues of how to address certain types of problems, the issues of how we're going to sanction them if there's a failure, making sure that we maintain a constant and consistently maintain messages is important to the fairness, their perceived treatment by the community, by the law enforcement, and by the powers to be that may issue out those sanctions. We want to also help them understand and define that proactive versus reactive calls for service. When is it the right time to call police? Do we wait for the person to now engage in somewhat violent behavior, or do we have the potential of saying, hey, this particular patron is creating problems for us and creating concerns for us? Call the law enforcement officers, they come out, they're able to more easily remove that patron in an earlier process than waiting for things to escalate and create higher levels of problems and potential violence. Next slide, please. One aspect of this was, how do we get in the door? And this was kind of an interesting thing for me because I did have some retailers who were very resistant to opening up to law enforcement, thinking that we were going to come in and create problems for them, scrutinize what they were doing, look for ways to get them, caught up in some kind of case, etc. One aspect that we wanted to do was just simply build that relationship from a positive standpoint, from a proactive, we're there to help type of response. And so some of those things include the beat officers taking the time to just simply stop in, saying hi, giving them a point of contact, the supervisors over a district saying, hey, I'm the supervisor of this particular district. If there's anything you need, any problems you have, feel free to get a hold of me. We'll be happy to try to help. And if we can't help you directly, then we'll put you in touch with people who can. Offering specific types of assistance. If they have concerns over customers who are acting out of character or suspected in maybe potentially drug dealing or something like that, offering the opportunity for us to send agents in to further identify individuals who might be creating additional concerns for the licensee and helping that establishment build a reputation as being a responsible reputation and one that the community would really enjoy and embrace and be able to spend money and make them again successful. That community reputation is important. I think many of us have probably seen movies, and one movie that really stands out to me when we talk about bar environments is the movie Roadhouse. And in that movie, Patrick Swayze talks about to his staff, do people want to come to a slaughterhouse? do people want to be in an environment where drugs are being, you know, sold frequently and where fights are commonplace? And that's kind of that community reputation that licensees may build. Do they want a reputation of being a teen bar or a thug bar, places where violence occurs or where kids are there and creating additional problems and concerns? So establishing community relationship and working with that licensee to build the reputation of that licensee, build the community reputation as well. Next slide, please. Now, part of what we can do in that process and getting in the door is things as basic as training. And we've already heard both Giselle and Paul talk about training issues within the licensees, and in particular, getting to the basics to start with. How to detect illegal IDs, and I know Paul spent a little time talking about that. I think that's a very good foundation program to be able to make that initial entry into a licensee, build some relationships in that process. I know from my experiences of doing this for many, many years that the employees of those licensees will typically embrace that particular aspect of training very, very well. And as they do that, then they'll start seeing some success for themselves and we'll be able to move further in that process. Also taking the time to be involved in employee orientations. So now when the owner manager is giving an orientation to new employees, law enforcement stepping in, and sharing in that responsibility of making sure that the employees understand the role that they play in making a safe environment, preventing youth access, preventing overintoxication, is really, really an important aspect of that. Responsible beverage service, as Giselle mentioned, is also a critical component. I know there are a number of programs out there. Proof 21 is part of that. TIPS, as I've indicated, as being a trainer, is also an important part of that. One of the things I really believe about RBS-type training programs is that it needs to be an in-person training. A number of companies have gone to offering online training. And the way I've kind of perceived it and the way we've dealt with it in my community is that alcohol service is an in-person type of contact, and the training, therefore, should also be an in-person kind of contact. So we can share and discuss ideas about issues that may come up in the service of alcohol and further advance that opinion or reputation of the licensee and to ensure that things are occurring in the right manner. From the advanced training, as alluded to in the bio, we developed here in Champaign a number of years ago a bar security training program. Too often, bar security personnel are hired with the concept of they're there to take care of problems, but given inadequate training to be able to properly address that. And so one of the issues that typically comes up is a bar security person who now is dealing with a problem and resorts to physical restraint and may not have the appropriate training to do that. So let's say he puts a headlock on, and in fact, a headlock creates an injury to that particular customer. First off, a headlock looks somewhat violent. Secondly, the potential for that injury is increased, and ultimately the licensee may face a civil suit because of the action of that security personnel. So it's an opportunity for these types of training programs to really give security personnel the right kind of information about what their legal authority is and to be able to move forward with that. Additionally, risk management training. If we can go in and help a licensee identify areas of risk for the establishment, even to the extent of occupancy issues and making sure that the occupancy level is appropriate for the bar, it's not all that long ago that we as a nation experienced a couple of significant tragedies with the Station Club in Rhode Island and the E3 disaster in Chicago, where we had a number of people killed as a result of some risk management issues, not having the appropriate types of things the appropriate type of training for personnel to better be able to handle those types of situations. So giving them responsibilities and understanding of what role the staff play in risk management, as well as giving guidance on the types of things that the create risks for the licensee. Next slide, please. One aspect of this is recognizing the benefits of training. As I've gone through my experiences over the years, worked with a number of communities, worked with a number of bars, one of the things that I tend to see is that if it's a typical licensed type of business that's not necessarily associated to a chain, there tends to be somewhat of a lack of professionalization in it. in retail, in any other businesses, you would walk in as a new employee. You would be given an orientation program and typically an employee handbook with guidance, rules, et cetera, for that employee to follow. So creating standardized policies and procedures for individuals within that industry are important. The expectation of some level of internal training as well, recognizing that employees would be accountable for their actions and sharing that accountability, whether it be civil liability, criminal liability, that type of thing, and how that civil and criminal liability or that accountability works its way up to the owner, and the fact that you have employees who don't necessarily have that vested interest. Also, the conveying of the ownership's philosophy. What do we want those employees to really do? What's the standard of operation, standard of excellence this particular licensee wants to have? So those are also critical aspects of what we're trying to do in the training aspect we're involved in, and one of the benefits of that training that we're also involved in. Providing the understanding of do's and don'ts, conveying what the statutes and ordinances are so that people can clearly understand what the legal authority is. And then lastly, since I've already talked about criminal and civil outcomes, the no secret aspect of things. Sharing information, not having secrets, making sure people understand what their roles and responsibilities are, again, are some of the benefits of these types of trainings. Next slide, please. Do we encounter reluctant partners? I can't say that I've got 100% compliance in Champaign. That's clearly, you know, a factor of this. Do I still have reluctant partners? Yes. Typically, the business owners are the ones who are the ones to step up and want to do the things correctly because they see the bottom line. They see the bigger picture. Most often, these breakdowns occur by staff members, and again, as I mentioned earlier, don't have a vested interest in the business. In a college environment in particular, if you ask employees of bars and taverns why they're involved, more often than not, it's not because of the financial gain, but it's because of the social opportunity that may occur. And so we want to get past that social opportunity and help them understand what level of interest they should have in that business and the success of that business. Also, the past history of perceived or bad or negative experiences, whether they be with police or community perceptions, this is a bad club. We want to work with them and eliminate those negative experiences, or at least eliminate the perception of negative, and try to help them understand that we're there for their success. Yes, we have an enforcement mechanism. That's part of our job. But the more successful they are in doing things and being good neighbors, it makes our jobs that much easier, and then we can focus, again, our attention on areas that the community wants us to really focus on. Pointing out to them what's in it for them and proving the impossible. And I say that with kind of an interesting story to go with it. One of my licensees, actually it wasn't even one of my licensees, it was a neighboring community's licensee, was having some issues, and the owner had businesses in Champaign, and he and I spent some time talking about those. He was somewhat reluctant to engage in some of the activities. We spent some time talking about the types of activities he was experiencing, and after a period of time, convincing him to install some very basic camera systems in one particular club. This club was a small club, occupancy of less than 100. And after installing those camera systems in there, proving the impossible to him that you could make money and do things correctly, and spending time with the training issues, he was able to walk away in his first month of operation after following those procedures, saw a $25,000 increase in the bottom line. And so that's proving the impossible to him. He quickly became a supporter of what we were doing, of the programs that we were suggesting, implemented those in the majority of his licensees, and continued to implement until all of his licensees were incorporating serving training and incorporating camera systems and incorporating card-hard type programs. And ultimately, he became kind of a spokesperson for others in the community who maybe were reluctant. And when we brought him on board, we were able to bring others on board to help support the types of programs that we were offering at that particular time, and also help create additional programs. The correcting of bad behaviors is part of this as well, which is on the next slide. Offering incentives. Our community looks at, we want that compliant behavior. We would rather have the licensee step up to the plate and do things correct from the beginning, and we give them incentives for doing that. Fine reduction for licensees participating in a variety of programs, including server training and cops and shops and card-hard type programs. also incentives through the insurance companies with insurance breaks for having training. And if we can't be successful in offering the incentives, then in some cases we do have to have a little bit more of a stronger arm in this, get more directly involved, and do things like mandatory participation in designated programs. When we see that reluctance, the opportunity to go in and say, hey, we've given you some opportunities to try to fix it. We want to help you fix it. And, you know, so what we'll do is we're going to show you by forcing you to go through this program that there is some opportunity for that improved environment. Next slide, please. Now, as far as the enforcement for on-premise licensees, obviously compliance checks are fairly standard practice, both bars, taverns, and restaurants. When we talk about bars and taverns, typically, you know, sending minor decoys in, looking for violations, attempting to make a purchase. And same thing with restaurants. There are challenges with both of those. Restaurants that don't necessarily have standalone bars, you have that issue of how do we show or how are we able to help them gain compliance and understand their need to serve correctly. Restaurants oftentimes have a higher turnover rate, and so that involvement in employee orientation becomes more important. And again, that attitude of they want to be a good employee and they want to be a good neighbor being conveyed to those employees. Cooperative enforcement programs, cops and shops. I know Paul mentioned he'd like to see a cops and shops program for on-premise type locations. And in fact, there are some that have been created, badges and bars being one of those. It's a variation, obviously, of cops and shops. It puts law enforcement working directly with doormen, puts law enforcement directly monitoring the behaviors of employees, looking for adults outside of bar employees providing alcohol to minors in environments where the minors might be able to be present. So working cooperatively with owners, encouraging those types of things, again, building that reputation. Another type of cooperative enforcement program would be Operation Trapdoor, which is specific to carding issues, where a number of licensees in a specific geographical area would have police officers assigned to them. And as the doormen are able to recognize potential fake IDs, having the officers there to be able to address the illegal use of that ID immediately, as opposed to a lot of cases where the licensee will take the ID and turn it over to law enforcement. And the opportunity and ability to follow up on that violation becomes a lot less for lack of appropriate identification of the individual who presented the illegal ID. So those are some of the things we do in the cooperative enforcement programs that really, really are important. Next slide, please. Some of the other things that we would consider would be covert operations. Oftentimes, owners recognize that their employees may not be acting within the policies of the business, and supporting those owners by providing undercover officers who can monitor employees for certain types of violations, free alcohol giveaways, other types of situations that may come up. Some of the other things we would look at is service to intoxicated, violation of happy hours. In our state, we do have a happy hour law that's very significant in ensuring that we are in compliance with that one drink per customer type of rule, making sure that the alcohol is getting in the appropriate hands, et cetera. Employee consumption is mentioned, and then also employee theft and alcohol giveaways as being issues that would need to be addressed. Next slide, please. Next slide. Okay, thank you. One of the keys to success that I think, or actually the overall key to success, is we must build the trust. We have to rely on each other. Law enforcement cannot do it on their own. Licensing bureaus cannot do it on their own. It has to be a relationship that's open and honest with good communication. We must recognize that all of us have shortcomings in some of the things that we do, and we must identify those as quickly as possible and work to overcome those. And I think overall the biggest key is we've got to recognize the goals of both law enforcement and the community and the licensee, and be willing to share those goals with each other, come to some common ground, and move in that direction. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Scott, and thank you all for your informative presentations. While we're waiting for those callers to get into the queue, I'd like to ask Gazula a question. A lot of RBS programs are out there and available for licensees to participate in. So I guess the question I'd like to ask you is, how is the 21 Proof program different from other training opportunities that are out there?
That's a good question. I think that to start with, the way that it was created is very different. The real collaboration between the licensees, the preventionists, and also the license commission really kind of allowed it to grow in a way that would be, you know, most beneficial to all those involved. The fact that it was created in collaboration with the license commission, who also have police working with them, is really important. And that it was created based on those four, you know, essential components of RBS that Toomey listed. I'm not 100% sure, but I think our program is one of the only ones that has a separate section for managers and owners. We really think that it's important to be able to engage with managers and owners on a one-on-one kind of a way. And our trainings are very much designed to meet the needs of the establishment. Our trainer, Frank Connolly, has an in-depth conversation with every establishment before he goes out and does the training to get to know the establishment, to know what kinds of problems they may have seen, and anything in particular that the manager might want or the owner might want to address. And we do the trainings whenever is useful for them. I mean, because the trainers are on staff, we can do them pretty much 24/7. And of course, the fact that we, you know, we have a lot of local data in there, so it makes it very personable. It makes it very much, it helps make it, very pertinent to each individual establishment. And we have over 252 licensees here in Cambridge, and we're a city of, 101,000. So, you know, we have huge numbers of licensees, and it's really effective for us to make this as personable as possible.
Well, I think it's also worth reminding our listeners that the 21 Proof program did receive an award in 2007 from the National Association of State Alcohol and Drug Abuse Directors, and that surely is a credit to you and those who put that program together. James, do we have our first caller, our first question today?
Yes, you do, sir. It comes from Chaz from Illinois. Please proceed your question.
Welcome.
I'm sorry. How are you all doing today?
Doing great.
I was wondering, what type of incentives do you offer merchants to actually go ahead and help with this process and actually get, you know, like weak car hard signs and, you know, things like that? What type of incentives do you offer them in order for them to comply with the things that you're trying to do?
Most typically, the initial incentive is going to be some kind of fine reduction in the event that there were a violation to occur. The fact that they're taking affirmative steps in the early process allows for us to be able to say and recognize that fact. Also, from a standpoint of a clean record over the last couple of years, it makes it very easy if they've not had any violations for us to acknowledge their efforts in keeping our community safe and doing the right things by eliminating the potential fines that they would face.
Would any of you other presenters like to answer that question?
Well, I would say I think from Cambridge's perspective, one of the things, one of the incentives of taking 21 proof, first of all, is that if you end up before the license commission, they're so involved with it that that's always going to make you look good. I mean, I can't tell you how often someone fails a compliance check, and the next day Frank gets a call from them and says, hey, I need to set up a training as soon as I can. And they do that because they know that then when they go before the license commission, they're going to look a lot better. We also have worked to be on the to be an approved program or training service from the LLJUA, which is the Liquor Liability Joint Underwriters Association of Massachusetts. So if you take 21 proof and then you go there for your insurance, you get a reduced rate.
So it's kind of like being a member, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your call. Thank you for your question. James, is there another caller?
Yes, you. Our next question comes from Geraldine from Connecticut. Please proceed your question.
Yeah, my question could probably go to any one of the three speakers, but it had to do more with the any actions or interventions that you've taken to deal with the so-called predatory marketing tactics. I'm thinking of one school in our state down in the New Haven, Connecticut area where the bars plaster the campus with coupons. They refer to them as palm cards, little cards with major drink promotions or, you know, women get in free. And despite the fact that soliciting on campus is, you know, against school policy, it happens. They actually pay kids to do things in the residence halls, and I've actually heard that they pay kids with alcohol. So any thoughts on, you know, counteracting that kind of activity?
Who would like to take that question first? Paul, we haven't heard from you yet in the question and answer session. Would you like to give Garland some advice from a retailer's perspective as to how to approach businesses to stop entering into that type of marketing behavior?
Well, geez, that's the first time I've ever heard that one. I'd have to say that the best way, I think, would be to, and I know that sometimes it's very difficult to get in touch with these bar owners or managers, but maybe in conjunction with maybe a law enforcement officer or a license commissioner. But I think that going to speak to the bar owner may be the best way to sort of deal with this. I know that, I mean, I hear that, and I have red flags going off in my head all day long, and I would never do that. But
no, it doesn't sound like you would.
Yeah, but I mean, there are probably people out there, and obviously you're experiencing it. But you know, I think the best thing to do would be to try to contact that bar or restaurant and let them know that you know this is not acceptable, and you really can't do this. And I really don't know what more to say than that to that question. I mean, it really is just appalling to me.
We actually had a bar down in the Mystic, Connecticut area, so a seaport area, that was offering drink specials that was bring your own mug. So kids were bringing, you know, sawed-off milk containers. And we did draft a letter from local police, local campus officials, trying to cite some of the laws as to what a so-called, you know, serving size was legally to be. Although couldn't really find the fine print in our own statutes to really clearly define.
Were you able to talk to the license commission or the police about that? Not that specific about the mugs, but about this. Do you have any type of relationship with the license commission or the police?
Yes, I do personally. And this question was coming a little more indirect. I anticipate working a little bit more closely with universities in the future, but these are some of the issues that I know they're dealing with in terms of, you know, trying to get to the ads on the car windshields or the dormitory bulletin boards before they're, you know, viewed. But just wasn't sure if anyone else had a...
One aspect from a law enforcement perspective that we've dealt with when we've seen poor practices like that is that potential threat of additional checks, because ultimately you're going to have some level of increased call for service load. And so by, again, talking to the licensee is one good step. Another aspect, and it's amazing the power of universities that they have over students, and in particular, you know, you're looking at an environment where they're trying to get market share and they're trying to do anything they can to get the young people into their establishments. And so oftentimes what will happen is you can potentially work and identify locations that are creating a problem. And through working with, and we've had this occur, where coaches will ban certain locations because of the risk to their players. And those types of things have a huge impact on the licensee. The licensee doesn't want to get in a situation where they're going to lose business based on business practice, whether it be through threat of additional enforcement, more severe sanctions, or through loss of customer base based on policies of the university.
Well, thank you for that question, Geraldine. And certainly I know all of our presenters would be more than willing to assist you, as would I, in this issue as it's coming forward, and please feel free to contact us. James, are there any further questions in the queue?
Yeah, we have another question. It comes from, I believe it's pronounced Tenny from Michigan. Please proceed with your question.
Yes, hi. This is for Sergeant Scott. You mentioned in building relationships where they might have the concern that if they call the police, would it be used against them? And sort of in the same breath, you talked about looking at data in terms of reducing calls for service. It reminds me of our minor in possession laws. Sometimes the rates indicate
attention by police or trust of an establishment to report with police may increase those rates more than having it be the kids that are actually drinking. How do you separate that out?
It really comes back to the definitions that we're talking about in terms of proactive versus reactive, how effectively they are already managing their premises. If I have a licensee, and one thing I didn't mention about champagne is that we do have a 19-year-old entry into our licensed premises, so kids can get into the bars at 19 and 20. It creates a huge obstacle for us. The licensees that tend to employ policies that reduce the youth access. Example, one of my licensees doesn't allow anyone who's under 19 or under 21 to sit near the bar. They have to be like in the dance floor area, that type of thing. So they can't be actually directly up at the bar trying to make a purchase for concern of someone grabbing a drink, etc. They also have staff that routinely patrol, and if they identify individuals on the premises that are in possession of alcohol, that are underage, they'll take that alcohol away from them and you know, ask them to leave. In the event that there's a problem, this is where we really get into that reputation thing. Trying to build that reputation of that licensee to say we are responsible in this area. When they do call us, we tend to know that the issue that they want us to respond to is going to be something that we can go in and handle fairly easily, that it's not going to blow up. We're getting it earlier in the process as opposed to waiting for, you know, the blow up and the huge fight and those types of things. So encouraging that kind of behavior throughout the entire process.
Thank you.
Thanks
I
for the
know
question.
That, I'm sorry, could I just add a couple things here?
Absolutely.
I know that in speaking with the License Commission here in Cambridge, they do have an investigator at their office who deals with the reports that come in. And so I know that sometimes the reports that do come in, they investigate and they find out whether or not the places, the establishments are being proactive. And so they can sort of tell by the type of report that's filed, whether it was a fight because of refusal of entry or refusal to leave versus just like some kind of like mayhem or something, you know, a fight happening inside. So they do investigate further.
And I think that's a very strong point to make, Paul. And I think based on my experience, I tried to break this down with businesses that I had relationships with in a former career with law enforcement to let the retailer know if you're calling the police to take care of a problem you created, then you've got a problem. If you're calling the police to prevent a problem, then that's a good call. So I think that might be another way of kind of simplistically approaching it. James, do we have any other questions in the queue?
Yes, do we have one more question, and it comes from Mary from Pennsylvania. Please proceed with your question.
Hi. My question is about the training online, and it was mentioned briefly, for either owner managers or server sellers. And do we know, is there any data or any kind of feedback on is that effective or not effective?
Why don't we, when we're speaking of data, why don't we start with Gazela as the a person who's kind of worked with that. Do you have anything to offer Mary Beth?
Well, we haven't done online trainings with 21 Proof. And one of, I agree completely with Scott a little bit on his concern about, you know, it should be a person-to-person piece. And I don't have any data. I don't know, Scott Formiga might have some. I think that, you know, we put a heavy emphasis on role playing, and you have to, you know, consider that when you're putting together a training online. Like, how is that role playing going to look? But it's something that, you know, gets thrown around certainly, and certainly we are in conversations about it. Scott Formiga, did you have anything to add to that? Be on.
We're in conversations here in Pennsylvania, too, about that, and I just sort of wondered if maybe, you know, there was something already out
well,
there that we could...
And Mary Beth, just to add to that, I think one aspect of the concern that we see with online training is the verification that the individual who is certified actually took the training. Most oftentimes there's a process by which you enter certain information to say that this is an individual, but that information that may be entered is probably available to the employer and manager. And not to say that there are businesses out there that would do this, but I could see the potential where you would have a manager simply get online and enter and do a testing for an individual that would be going through the class for that individual as opposed to that individual participating. I think I talked to somebody once who mentioned that they went online and they were able to get a certification in 45 minutes, and that certification was valid for our state standards, which actually requires 6 hours of training. So that becomes a huge issue when you're able to do something condensed into a 45-minute, certification when the requirement is actually for six.
Right.
Well, thank you for your call, Mary Beth. And on behalf of the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention and the Underage Drinking Enforcement Training Center, I'd like to thank all of our guests for speaking today and our audience for calling in. If you have additional questions related to this call, please call the center at our toll-free number, which is 1-877-335-1287, or send an email to udetc@udetc.org, and we will be happy to provide answers or connect you with the resources that can help you. You can also contact our presenters using the contact information on our website. And for those who are not connected to the web presentation, I'd like to ask our presenters once again to provide their information. Gazila?
Okay. I am in Cambridge, Massachusetts. My email is GROTSAMGOV. And my phone number is 617-349-6283.
Thank you. How about you, Paul?
All right. My email address is paul@HongKongHarvard. That's all one word. HongKongHarvard. And my phone number here at the restaurant is 617-864-5311.
Thank you, Paul, and certainly we'd encourage anyone that's in Cambridge, Massachusetts looking for a meal to visit the Hong Kong Garden Restaurant.
Yes, thank you.
Scott, how about your information?
Yeah, I can be reached via email at scott.friedlein@ci.champaign.il.us. Also, you can reach me by cell phone at 217-649-8390, or I'm sure if you fire off an email to Pyre, they'll be happy to forward it to me.
Well, you're a brave man for giving us your cell phone call.
The easiest way to do business.
Yeah.
By the way, they also want to see me in Nashville, Tennessee at the UDEC conference. I'll be happy to talk to them there.
Well, it's good to know that you'll be performing there, too. And as we said earlier, this audio call has been recorded. And for those of you who would like to obtain a copy of the audio call, you can send a blank CD along with your name.